Right now, I would like to welcome Jack Leibowitz. He is the author of the book Hidden Harmony, The Connected Worlds of Physics and Art, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. So you're an emeritus professor of physics and former chairman of the art department at Catholic University of America. Was your first love art or science?
Science. But I discovered art in 1966 in Aspen, Colorado. I was invited as a brand new assistant professor
of physics.
I was at the University of Maryland at that time. I was invited to the Aspen Center for Physics for a retreat. They have them every summer for invited physicists. And I had never been west of the Mississippi before that. And it was a revelation. And
what was the revelation? The landscape? Or
a life-changing experience. The light, the violet skies, and the feel of the air in the Rockies. And it was overwhelming. It's not the East.
It is not the East,
not
indeed.
The East. And that started my involvement with art. I began to work with charcoals and pastels, but more important, to learn how to see. And I've been looking at art ever since.
Now, did you find that you had a gift for art, that you could draw, and that stuff came out of you didn't know you had?
To be immodest, I think yes, to some extent. You know, I still am involved with art. I'm now a pastelist, and I have taken lessons with our local wonderful artists, Anita West and Albert Handel. They travel all around the country, and they're very well-known artists. He shows at the Ventana Gallery at least once a year.
You write in your book, Hidden Harmony, about beauty, and beauty is found both in art and in science. And I'm asking you this as you, a scientist, what is the experience of beauty? What causes one to experience the feeling that something is beautiful?
I talk about that bit in the book, and I'd like to try to find it. In the first chapter, I mention that beauty is a guide both in physics and art. And Henri Poincaré, French mathematician and physicist, commented on it. And his comments, I think, are pervasive, not only for physics, but for art as well. Here, on page 7 it says, quoting him, "The basic research scientist does not study nature because it is useful to do so. He studies it because he takes pleasure in it. And he takes pleasure in it because it is beautiful." And this part's in italics. I mean, the intimate beauty that comes from the harmonious order of its parts, and that a pure intelligence can grasp. That aesthetic judgment guides great discoveries in physics, as well as in art. And of course, philosophers have been thinking about what is beauty ever since the ancient Greeks. But that comment by Poincaré covers a part of the issue.
So what are some examples of beauty in science?
Well, Einstein is Einstein's pioneering work is a good instance. He proceeded from the idea that the world has meaning. There were philosophers early in the 20th century who had a different view, but he always had faith in the idea that the world is meaningful. And that you can ask questions of the quotes, the old man, he used to refer to it, that suggested that there were answers to those questions about meaning. And these questions, because of his genius, were generally important beginnings for new thinking. And the questions had to do with notions, not just of meaning,
but beauty in nature. And in special theory of relativity, for example, such a question about meaning led to the idea of relativity. And then in general relativity, which supplanted Newton's idea of gravity, the same kind of thing arose.
Now, are you drawing a parallel between meaning and beauty?
The Poincaré comment comes in here. The harmonious order of the parts, subliminally, I think artists think the same way. And when Poincaré said that nature was beautiful, I think he meant it literally in those terms. And I guess I could say more about it.
So, well, nature is, it's funny, because nature is everything that we know. In, it seems like, in its beauty and its ugliness and its horror and its violence. Mm-hmm. It's not all harmony.
No.
By any means.
No. It,
and what does harmony even mean?
Well, I think when I think about it, I think about physical law. Physical law is remarkably meaningful. In the book, I talk about symmetry. And we all think of symmetry of objects. For example, your cup of coffee. If there were no handle and it were rotated by an invisible hand, you wouldn't know that it was turned because it would be the same in all directions. We would say that has rotational symmetry. And if you put the handle on and do the same thing, now we have the problem that the symmetry is broken in the sense that it's no longer rotationally symmetric. You can tell how many degrees it's been turned. Well, that sounds like a limited view of symmetry, symmetry of objects. And in fact, mathematicians have done quite a bit with that. The kind of symmetry I'm referring to is the symmetry of physical law. Now, we all learn in school that energy is conserved, that it can't be destroyed. And that seems not to be true because it changes its aspect. It has different forms. But in fact, the total energy of a system doesn't change. And that's true for other kinds of things that have strong physical meaning. And I don't want to get too clunky about this, but momentum, if we understand what it means, and angular momentum, and even time symmetry. And what we mean is, when we apply this all to physical law, that physical law has a symmetry that's very profound. For example, if I have a laboratory and I do an experiment here, and then I move the experiment, translate it to another place, we don't expect physical law to change. The same is true if we do the experiments at the laboratory at different times. Or if we turn the laboratory to a different angle. Those symmetries are built into nature. And the strange thing that can be shown mathematically is that each one of those symmetries is tied to what we call conservation laws in physics. When we mention time symmetry, that's equivalent, and it can be shown, as I said, mathematically. That's the same thing as saying that energy can't be destroyed.
Now, hold that idea. How does it translate into art?
Well, in art, symmetry is extremely important. The symmetry that we might mention to start with is the symmetry of the blank canvas. Now, to make it simple to think about that canvas is going in every direction arbitrarily far. And if I put an object on that canvas and then blindfold you and move the object with my hand, you can't tell the hand had been there. Now the object's in a slightly different position. But we have no way of knowing that because there's no reference point against which to compare it. Now, this is symbolically like what an artist confronts with his blank canvas or her blank canvas, or for that matter, the blank page in literature. or the score for musicians. And breaking that symmetry, that first brushstroke, begins the opportunity to find meaning, broken symmetry meaning. And now it's the job of the artist not just to willy-nilly put other strokes on the page, on the canvas, but to find a coherence and a unity and an organic unity, which makes it, which we say, which we comment about and saying it's good composition or whatever. The painter would say it's simply the painting works. And when they say it works, they know what they mean.
Well, that's, I mean, that's a huge question. You know, we know how we judge quality and what, you know, standards in science. We have standards of rigor. We have repeatability. You do an experiment. Other scientists try to disprove it by repeating it over and over again. And if it holds up, it holds up. How do you judge what works and doesn't work in art?
That's the difference between science and art. I don't pretend to try to convince the reader that they're the same thing. In fact, I point out that the art discussions and the physics discussions, as it happens, are take place in alternate pairs of chapters. The similarities are discussed, but at the very beginning, just as you say, there's a distinction. An artist looks for the kind of unity that we talked about. And artists know when their painting works. They say, literally, it works or it doesn't work. And there's a whole tradition and understanding behind that.
I know.
In physics, to answer your question, though, in physics it's different. New ideas, new theories have to be compatible with what came before, consistent with what we know already. And prediction has to be quite literal. This is something people don't understand when they talk about the quantum more freely than a physicist is allowed to do. Newton, for example, with his gravitation idea, said that when you take two masses and you separate them by a certain distance, the force becomes weaker. He just doesn't say it becomes weaker. He says it becomes weaker as the square of the distance. In other words, twice as far, it's four times as weak. Not 1.9999. There's a strong reason why it should be 2.0 exactly in Newton. And that's why mathematics turns out to be important in physics, because prediction is extremely important. And the author of the idea can fall on his own petard very quickly. That's a distinction.
I think the whole question of truth, which is part of this conversation, is also a distinction, because the truth, you know, of the molecular structure of glucose is, that's not going anywhere. That's not changing. Truth in art is something that is something we recognize, but it's awfully slippery.
Yeah. Should we talk about the physical idea first? A physical idea, let's start here. People have talked about the development of physical ideas as like turning the successive layers of an onion. I think it's more like a picture puzzle, but not the kind we know of. An infinite picture puzzle, no boundaries. And what's more, so there's an open-endedness about, quotes, truth in science. The glucose is a fact, but a theory, it has an internal consistency. But as we expand the picture puzzle, an expanded view of what is comes about. And that's where the tentative nature is. I'll give you a homely metaphor. You start your picture puzzle and you see a little arc. Your theory is now called the theory of the arc. Now, in the next generation, they discover that that arc becomes a closed loop. So now, it doesn't disprove the old notion,
right?
But it's expanded, but not just expanded. It takes on new meaning. Now, if you can go further with this.
So an example would be, you can build a house with Newtonian physics, but then Einsteinian physics
exactly.
builds on that.
And Einstein's ideas had to be compatible in the limit in which Newton worked with Newton's theories. And yet what made them very valuable was that they went beyond. Now that little arc might have four holes inside. Now we have the button theory.
Right.
So the internal consistency is not lost, but our vantage point grows. And the thing about nature that most people believe, physical world, most people believe, is that there's no end to it. It isn't as though we'll know ultimately what is. And that's what's gorgeous about it.
I think when you talk about, you know, the arc turning into the circle, turning into the buttons with the four holes, something that is easy to lose sight of is that science is a collection of metaphors, as is art.
Of course. We have to think metaphorically because we're very limited. And, well, of course, that becomes especially obvious in modern physics when we discover that the world of experience has been left behind a long time ago, and that the world of the quantum, the world at the level of the atom, where particles are waves and waves are particles.
You're not going to see that, and you're walking through the Santa Fe Baking Company.
No, and you'll want metaphor to help you along the way.
Right. We're talking to Jack Leibowitz, author of the book Hidden Harmony, The Connected Worlds of Physics and Art, and he will be speaking tomorrow, Friday, at 7 o'clock at the New Concept Gallery at 610 Canyon Road. So you have put out this wonderful metaphor of the endless picture puzzle going in all directions, but we still haven't gotten to the question of truth in art. Why are some artists great and, you know, express truth that last for through the ages, and others kind of die out like an extinct species or something?
It's a very individual kind of question.
Is it?
To some extent, there are artists that were very, very lionized in their time, and we don't even think about them anymore. On the other hand, there are others who maintain their currency. Some of the Impressionists.
Or who were thought to be ahead of their time.
You know, I like Renoir among the Impressionists. I like others too. But the reason I mention him is that there are people today who don't think much of Renoir. Cézanne. There are many people, I think, who would, in thinking about the Impressionists, would say that their favorite is Monet. Well, my favorite is Cézanne, who became a post-Impressionist, too. There are more stark examples. In 1434, Van Eyck made a painting that's very well known. It's the marriage of Arnold Fini, the Arnold Fini wedding. And if you look at that, you might say, well, I don't like that. Very lugubrious groom and pregnant bride and all of that. But that painting is a master of composition. Masterwork of composition, I suppose I should say. That's a hard question.
It is a hard question. It's one I was an art history student way back in the day, and it was it may not even be the most important question, but it does seem to come up when you have these whole issues of objective truth in physics, and then you're making parallels to art.
Cubism, analytical cubism, 1907 or 8 until 1912. Braque and Picasso were the prime movers, especially in that particular period. I love it. But there are people who don't like analytical cubism, don't like cubism. It's so rich and beautiful. But, well, and let's take Jackson Pollock. Now, he doesn't have many fans among the general populace, but in Washington, D.C., the East Building of the National Gallery, there's a Jackson Pollock called Lavender Mist, and it fills almost a whole wall. And there's a bench, and you can sit at the bench and spend as much time as you want. The bench is just the right distance away from that. Now, people sometimes have trouble with images that aren't literal. If you were to tell people you're really looking at a garden through a lattice work, that might make them happier. But it's a very abstract painting. And it turns out that it has a structure and a substructure and beyond that, it's remarkable. It's a wonderful painting. But my son went to visit with me there one day, and he said, being polite, "Why do you like that?" So I had to tell him why I like that. But it is very individual. Other people like that. It occupies the whole wall. It's probably one of his best paintings.
Jack Leibowitz is the author of the book Hidden Harmony, The Connected Worlds of Physics and Art, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Jack Leibowitz, unfortunately, it's time to go, but thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.